just didn't feel any liberty whatsoever to preach that message. Well, the problem with that was the message for tonight went along with this morning, so had to work on a message this afternoon. I just want to bring some thoughts. Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. We'll read verses 24 through verse 27. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not. The reason, it was founded upon a rock. And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it. These verses are the closing application of what is known as the Sermon on the Mount, the longest recorded sermon of Jesus Christ. There's a lot of lessons to be learned in the Sermon on the Mount. And when Jesus says here in his closing application, whosoever doeth them, he's referring to everything he has said in this Sermon on the Mount. And whosoever heareth them and doeth not, that is what he had just spoken in the Sermon on the Mount. It's like a foolish man who built his house upon a sand. Matthew gives the fullest account. There's only Matthew and Luke are the only two who record the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew gives the longest account, chapters 5, 6, and 7. Luke only records the sermon, Luke 6, verses 20 through 49. However, Luke gives the fullest account of what transpired leading up to the sermon. But in the sermon, Christ presents a portrait of a true disciple, how they should think, how they should act with regard to this life. What the Sermon on the Mount offers is instruction concerning a very, very specific way of living. And Christianity is a way of living. It's not just a way of believing. It is a way of believing, but it is a way of believing that affects our way of living. It is a way of living that is not of this world. It is a way of living that is not from this world. It's a way of living that is quite foreign to the world. The Sermon on the Mount is a description of what a child of God should be, how they ought to live their lives. I believe it's the most comprehensive statement in the Word of God concerning a child of God's role. It covers the entire Christian life. I don't believe that there are very many people who really, everybody, all saved people, know of the Sermon on the Mount. And many can tell you some things about it. But there aren't many that have ever really grasped what is being taught in the Sermon on the Mount. And I believe the Sermon on the Mount is a good litmus test for our own spiritual development and for the spiritual impact that we make. Jesus, when he preached this sermon, did not do so just as merely a setting down of rules, but again, he's speaking of a life to be lived. It is a call for God's people to live for Christ. Jesus closes the sermon in our text by saying, those who conform to this message, those who pattern their life after what Jesus has just said, it is like building their house upon a rock. And therefore, they will endure the trials of life. He talks about the rain descending. That's trials, testings that come from above. He also speaks of the floods. Floods come from below. Trials can come from above. Trials can come from below. They can both come at the same time. But then he speaks of the winds, plural. The winds blew. And I think of that as all directions. And so the flood, or so the trials of life, can come from above, from beneath, and from all around. And there are times when they come from all of those directions at one time. But the person who patterns their life after what Jesus said in this sermon is like the man who builds his house upon a rock, and no matter which direction the storms come from, that house stands. And vice versa. If one refuses to pattern their life after what Jesus said, they're like a foolish man who built his house upon sand. The house might look good. It might look as nice as the one built upon a rock. But it doesn't endure. It doesn't stand the test of time. I am so thankful to know people who have stood the test of time. We have several here. You have stood, most here, have stood the test of time. Time says a lot. I tell people all the time, well, time will tell. And it does. It does. But those who have stood the test of time, they have something. I've known people who appear very, very strong, but the first trial that comes their way, they can't handle it. They're really not strong at all. They appear to be, but they're really not. Then there are others who may not appear as strong, but they have withstood the storms. It's because they have something. And we want to consider tonight the life founded upon a rock. Life founded upon a rock. And we just want to do a quick survey. I'm not very good at that, but a quick survey of the Sermon on the Mount. And we see this life that we are to live. And it is a life that is founded upon a rock. Number one, it is a life that far, far exceeds mere religion. We speak much upon that subject. But I believe the main thought the main precept in the Sermon on the Mount, is stated in Matthew 5, verse 20, and Matthew 5, verse 48. Matthew 5, 20, he says, "For I say unto you, that except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." You got to keep in mind who he's talking to. In Luke, he went up into the mountain to pray, and his disciples were with them, and of them he chose 12. The disciples and the apostles come down that mountain with Christ, and there's a great multitude of people. And Luke says in chapter 6 that he looked upon his disciples. That's who he's addressing. He's addressing his church, he's addressing the saved. And it's in the hearing of a multitude that had come to that place because of the healing miracles of Christ. And Christ says, except your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. You have to have something that goes beyond the scribes and the Pharisees. He also says in verse 48 in that same light, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. What he's saying is religion is not your standard. God is the standard. But I believe everything in this sermon centers around these two verses. Matthew 5:20, Matthew 5:48. And I believe those two verses tell us how you attain everything spoken of in the sermon. I believe those two verses serve as a warning not to rely upon, not to rest upon wrong things. They serve as a warning not to wrongly analyze our spirituality. The only proper way to analyze spirituality is God is the standard. Other people are not the standard. You will not properly analyze your spirituality if you use other people as a standard of measurement, even if it's the most faithful of people. God is the standard of measurement. Again, Matthew 5:20, except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. The very word righteousness implies that there is a standard, that there is a standard, there is a measurement, a means to measure righteousness. That is, there's some principle to measure righteousness. There's some guideline, there's some benchmark, there's some example to measure righteousness. And that example is not the scribes and the Pharisees. That example is not the religious. That example is God. He's perfect. And that's our standard of righteousness. What he's saying is that we have to strive for the highest. We do not strive for to be like the most religious. Our standard is much higher. Our standard is God. We strive for the highest. That's this life that he's speaking of. It is a striving for the highest. Someone says, "Oh, I would just love to be like brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so." You've set your standards way too low. I don't care who brother so-and-so is. You've set your standards way, way, way too low. God is our standard. The problem is, you set your standard on brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so, you may actually bypass them. But you'll never even reach the level of God. So there's something to always be striving for. So we must strive for God's highest. It exceeds all the so-called righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees or their view of righteousness. And you talk to God's people, and almost everyone has a view of what constitutes righteousness. The scribes and the Pharisees, they were the religious individuals of Christ's day. Not merely the religious, they were the religious elite of Christ's day. And as you read the scriptures, you see that Christ was always at war, always at odds with these people, and they with him. And we see that these were a people who were more interested and zealous guarding their religion and tradition than they were learning the truth of God. They were more concerned about the way they've always done things or about tradition than they were the truth. They were outwardly moral. And we don't condemn anyone for being outwardly moral. But they had no regard for the inward. None whatsoever. They were self-righteous, thinking themselves better and superior than others. And they based this upon their outer performance. Everything was a performance. They were desirous of preeminence. They were desirous of public salutations. They were very, very fond of titles. I always get a little scared of an individual who insist upon being called by a title. That worries me. That's how the scribes and Pharisees were. They were very partial in their observance of God's law. And by that I mean they've kind of picked and chose what they would obey. The scribes and Pharisees were very intent, but they were also very content in playing a role for the sake of appearance. Three times in the sermon, Jesus warned, "Be not to be as the hypocrites are." Chapter 6, verse 2, verse 6, and verse 16. So this life that Jesus is presenting is more than just playing a part. It's a life. It's a life. It is a righteousness that surpasses the scribes and Pharisees because it's an imparted righteousness as the result of the new creation, as a result of salvation. And according to Romans 7, verse 22, this imparted righteousness delights in the law of God. It doesn't ignore God's law. It delights in the law of God. Also, it causes, in Romans 7, verse 25, it causes the saved to serve the law of God. So this life does not disregard the life of God. It is a righteousness that delights in the law of God. But the truth that we have to get a grasp upon is as it is a righteousness that is not the product of man. You can raise your children and you can create little robots. They act like little Christians, but they're not saved. They're not saved, but you can, and they can even grow up and be robots, but they're still lost. They do not have a righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Secondly, it is a life that requires certain attitudes. One can obey God and have a terrible attitude in doing so, which in truth they don't obey God. But this life requires certain attitudes. Matthew chapter 5, the opening statements of the sermon is known as the Beatitudes, or Be This. And what it is, it's the spirit that is required to live the life that is being described. It's not just the outward. There's a spirit that is required in living this life. And this spirit is part of the righteousness that surpasses the scribes and the Pharisees. And these are things that are to be our attitudes at all times. And the very first one mentioned is the foundational one. Be ye poor in spirit. Again, this is part of the righteousness. Be ye poor in spirit. And the truth is, everything in the sermon comes back to that. Be poor in spirit. What that means is that we have a personal awareness of our own sin. We have a personal awareness of our own unworthiness. We have a personal awareness of our own spiritual deficiency. And that results in an awareness, I need God's help. And that is the spirit of this life that is being described. I need the help of God to live this life. Also mentioned are spiritual mourning, spiritual meekness, spiritual hungering, spiritual thirsting after righteousness, after His righteousness. A spirit of mercy, a spirit of purity, purity of heart, purity of life. It's also a spirit of peace. And Jesus says the result of having these attitudes will be persecution. Matthew 5, verses 10 and 11. But the possessor of these attitudes, in their persecution, while they are experiencing persecution, will be able to rejoice and be exceeding glad. You see, their life is a house upon a rock. Persecution does not stop them. Oppressive governments throughout the history of man have tried to oppress Christianity. But persecution has never oppressed Christianity. The problem in all of those countries is that Christianity grows. That's the problem. They can't stamp it out. We see it in the book of Acts. We see it all through history. Christianity seems to grow when it's persecuted. Perhaps that's one of our greatest problems in this country, is that we don't have persecution. And the tendency is to grow lax. But again, this life requires certain attitudes. It is a life that requires a realization that we have a function. And it is a God function in the world. And we see this in verses 13 through 16 of chapter 5. We are to function as salt. We are to function as light in the world. That is, we're separate and apart from the world. And we are to function as salt and we are to function as light for the glory of God. You notice verse 16, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father, which is in heaven. Salt and light reveal that the child of God is separate from the world. Reveal that this life is one that the child of God is unique to the world. But that the child of God is to make an impact upon the world. Now, one individual, none of us as an individual, can make an impact upon the entire world. But we can make an impact in our world, in your neighborhood, in your family. We need to get our world a little smaller. And if you can't make an impact in that smaller world, what in the world makes you think you'll make an impact in all the world? It's not going to happen. We are to have an impact. And this life that he is talking about is a life that impacts other individuals. Again, it is a righteousness that exceeds mere religion. It is a possessing of attitudes that we've already mentioned. And this is what enables us to be light. This is what enables us to be salt in the world. That requires that we speak. It requires that we live right before others. And those who do so, they're like their life is built upon a rock. Fourthly, it is a life that requires a proper spirit toward the law of God. Most of the sermon, or a large portion of the sermon, is taken up with that subject. It is addressed in verses 17 through 48 of chapter 5. Again, in verse 16, he mentions good works. That is just prior to the next subject that he's going to speak upon, which is a right attitude toward the law of God. In verse 17 and 18, he says, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets." So this life involves a thinking correctly concerning the law of Christ. Concerning Christ and the law of God. Verse 19, he speaks of the seriousness of breaking the law of God. "Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so." We can teach men to break the commandments by breaking them ourselves. We can teach them in our theology as well. "He shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So we must realize God has a law. God has laws. We must realize the seriousness of breaking the laws of God. And then in verse 20, he addresses the fact that the law goes further than the outward. The law goes past just obeying outwardly. Just because one obeys outwardly does not make them right with God. The law goes further than that. These things must be realized if we're going to think correctly concerning this righteousness that we must have. In verse 21 through verse 47, Christ takes the law of God beyond the letter of the law. He does so by repeatedly saying, what he does is he says what the Old Testament law is, and then he says, "But I say unto you." And he does that repeatedly. What he's saying is the law goes further than the letter. The Old Testament law says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that if a man looketh upon a woman to lust after her, in his heart he hath committed adultery with her already." He's saying, I'm taking it further than the letter of the law. So these individuals that say, "Well, I didn't touch," but you still broke the law. Christ takes it further. Are we to obey the letter of the law? Yes, we are. But it goes further than that. It goes further than that. And again, we must realize these things. He warns, as he presents this subject, he warns against the spirit of murder. Thou shalt not kill, but he that is angry in his heart is guilty. Takes it further. He speaks of the spirit of adultery. He speaks of the spirit of disregarding the sanctity of marriage. He speaks of the spirit of promoting ourselves. He speaks of the spirit of retaliation. He speaks of the true spirit of love. And then he ends that section with the righteousness of God, verse 48. Matthew 5, 48. We are to seek the righteousness of God. God's righteousness is our standard. We're to strive for God's highest. So this standard of living has a right attitude concerning God's laws, but also realizes that it goes beyond just the letter of the law. There's a spirit. There's an attitude that is involved as well. You can do the right thing, but in the wrong way, in the wrong attitude. And therefore, it's not the right thing. It's disobedience. It is a life of spiritual activities. Matthew 6, verses 1 through 4. He teaches that the child of God is to serve and to do good. Or to serve and to do good. In other words, it's not just a life unto ourselves. But they are to serve and do good, not to be seen and recognized or approved of men. We're to serve and do good because it pleases God, because God is glorified, not because of recognition. Matthew 6, verses 5 through 13. The child of God is to pray, but not to be seen, not to be recognized and thought highly of men. Do I believe when you go to a restaurant, you ought to pray? Yes, I do. You ought to bow your head and pray. Do I believe you ought to fall on your knees before the table and make sure everyone in the room hears you praying? Not if that's not how you pray at home. That's making a show. That's making a show. We're to pray. We're to be a people of prayer. But the purpose is not to be seen. The purpose is not to get recognition. Matthew 6, verses 14 and 15. We're to forgive. We're to be a people of forgiveness. People wrong us, and we are to be a people of forgiveness, realizing that we too need to be forgiven. Also in verse 16 through 18, the child of God is to fast. And again, he goes into that not to be seen and recognized of men. This is what is involved in this life. There's activities in this life upon the rock. What all of that is saying is we're to live life in the presence of God, for the glory of God, not for show. It is living life with a God motive. I do this because it pleases God. I dress right because it pleases God. As a woman, I dress like a woman because it pleases God. As a man, I dress like a man because it pleases God. I don't believe in parading around naked, because that doesn't please God. I don't go here, I don't go there, because it wouldn't please God. This is a life all about pleasing the Lord, not about pleasing men. of pleasing the Lord. You hope, there's a time, your children, they don't want to displease you. There comes a stage in their life where it seems like that's what they set out to do, is to displease. But what you and I have to realize is it's not about pleasing us. And if they never get past, I got to please mom and dad, they won't amount to much spiritually. At some point, they've got to come to the realization this is about God. This is about God. And I believe in dressing the way I dress because, not because mom and dad told me to do that for 20 years, because that's what God says. They have to develop their own convictions and live for the glory of God. Sixthly, it is a life of right priorities. Jesus covers that in Matthew 6, verses 19 through 34. As you read this sermon, it's a wonderful lesson in homiletics. There is a very, 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 very definite outline. There is a very definite goal that he's striving for in the teaching. And it's very orderly. Very orderly. But he speaks in verses 19 through 34 that priorities must be right. And he tells us how to achieve right priorities. In verses 19 through 21, he says, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be." There will your heart be. And where your heart is, that's it. Where an individual lays up his or her treasure, manifest what they appraise, what they assess to be most valuable in their life, what they assess to be most important in their life. So what Jesus is teaching us is if you're going to have right priorities, it begins with right values. You have to properly assess everything. Everything. It is a warning against adopting values and priorities and lifestyles of the world. Wrong values are a great detriment to the Christ life. They are a great detriment to living this life that is being described. And wrong values, and we've preached on this many times, will fill your life with junk. That's what fills your life with all of our lives with junk, is we do not properly assess. We do not put a right value upon things. There must be right loyalties, and that will follow if we have right values. He mentions that in verse 24 of Matthew chapter 6, that no man can serve two masters. Cannot serve two masters. This is a life that serves one master, God. And that is a life built upon a rock. And the storms will come, and that house will stand. That life will endure. He goes on, he mentions right concerns. He talks about praying for food and raiment. Life, meat, drink, clothing, tomorrow. And he says, don't worry about these things. Get your concerns in the right order. So this is a life that has right priorities, right values, right loyalties, right concerns. We get concerned about things that we should not be concerned about. or at least they shouldn't consume our whole day. And then he talks about right pursuits. But seek ye, verse 33, but seek ye first the kingdom of God. That's the result of right values, right loyalties, right concerns. You'll pursue the right things. This life that's built upon this rock is all of those things. Lastly, it's a life of reverence to God. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, we're to see, we're to judge sin in our own lives before we judge it in others. He's not saying that we shouldn't judge it in others. He's saying you judge it in your own life first. It's a matter of order. In verses 7 through 12, he says, you're to reverence God so much that you seek God in everything that you do. Verses 13 and 14, we're to strive after God. Verses 15 through 20, we must rightly discern between truth and false, right and wrong. And the one who lives this life is able to discern the difference between truth and error, between what's right and what's wrong. And they're not swayed by the world's definition of what's true and what's error, or what's right and what's wrong. Verses 21 through 23, we're to make sure of our profession. We're to make our calling and election sure, as Paul put it. We're to make sure that we're saved, because you can live like a saved person to some degree without possessing salvation. So he's saying, make sure you're saved. And if we do these things, our life is like that wise man who built his house upon a rock. So our life is not about personal fulfillment. It's not even about happiness. It's not about careers. It's not about achievements. Certainly not about the acquisition of things. It's not about human approval, because the world does not approve of this life. Most of the religious world does not approve of this life. It's all about Him. And we say that over and over and over again. But it's true. It's a way of living in which Christ's throne is established in our hearts. And His power is in our hearts. And His power is upon our lives. It's living in the light of His ownership. Living in the light of His authority. You see, people say, well, your church won't let you do such and such. Well, I hope that's not so. I hope it is. God won't let me do such and such. God is in my heart. And that's what keeps us from doing certain things. That's what propels us to serve the Lord. It is living life exalting Christ and in submission and obedience to His laws. All a child of God should need is, thus saith the Lord. That's all they should need. If the Lord says, and He does, clothe yourselves, that should be enough. What else do you need? If the Lord says you should give a tithe and an offering, and He does, what else do you need? That's all you need. Is God saying it? And there are a lot of things God does not say directly, but the principles are there if you have any sense at all. There's biblical principles. This way of life is Living by God's standards. Living by the standards of God. I hope that there's no one who says, well, I don't do that, that would displease the pastor. I don't do that, that would displease brother so-and-so. I hope you have a higher motive than that. I don't do that because it would displease God. Someone says, well, I think, it doesn't matter what you think. You need to get your thoughts in line with what God says. You're not smarter than God. Get your thoughts in line with what He says. It's living life dedicated and devoted and committed to the Lord. It's sad that child of God gets up in years and they still don't have a clue what it is to live dedicated, devoted, committed to the Lord. It is a clearly stated and decided life for God. And the storms will come. The rains will descend. The floods will arise. The winds will blow. And they'll beat upon that house. But it stands. And that's our life. That is to be our life. If we can live the Sermon on the Mount, we will endure. We will endure. We will stand the test of time. We'll stand the test of time. Will stand the test of all the storms because our life is built upon a solid foundation. Each one of us has to make sure that we have a solid foundation. Christ, of course, is that foundation. If not, it's like building upon the sand. It looks good. I've seen, you have too. I've seen preachers come and go. They burst on the scene and people get excited. Oh man, they're great. Time will tell. Time will tell. And it does. And many of them have fallen by the wayside. They look good. But the storms came. Time happened. And they fell by the wayside. It always disturbs me a little bit. I'm speaking in the context of preachers. Here you have the old preachers. Been standing firm for 50 years. Young guy comes on and man, he can preach. Everybody's got to have him. Looks good. There's those old guys. Stood the test of time. And they'll continue to stand the test of time. This young guy, he looks so good. Or it may not even be a young guy. It can be an older guy. But he's new on the scene. People like new things. But he don't last. Time will tell. And we look around, and there are those who have stood the test of time. And you ought to appreciate those folks. You ought to appreciate them. Whether it be a female or male, doesn't matter. You ought to appreciate those who stand the test of time. Those who have had trials in their life. And they're still in the house of God. Still serving the Lord. That's a testimony. Are they perfect? No. But they are an encouragement. And that ought to be our desire. To be that person. That just stands the test of time. I've said this before. There's some people, quite a few, that They're not in church, and I know something's wrong. They're sick. Something's happened where they can't be here. There's others. They're not here, and I'm afraid to ask. Because I know more than likely nothing's wrong. Well, there's something wrong, but it's not what they think. Thank God. If you're a person who, when you're not here, people know you can't be. They just know. That's a testimony. We ought to strive for such a life, to be able to endure what's coming. Because it's not going to get any easier. There's going to be more things to endure. And time will tell. Time will tell who's real and who isn't. I I'm not bragging, but I usually don't get caught up in the excitement of a new guy. I just kind of sit back and we'll see. We'll see. Don't get too caught up in all the frills and all the excitement. Just wait on God. Brother Larry, if you'd come and lead us.